welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, old masters, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 16, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a woman who's been child entrepreneur, web developer, artist, and political fundraiser. She's now even a podcaster, talking about games on Isometric, tech on Rocket, and geek culture with regular appearances on The Incomparable. But without a doubt, she's best known for leading the game studio Giant Space Cat and being a prominent and outspoken feminist advocate in the games industry. She is, of course, Ms. Brianna Wu. Brianna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, you are here to talk about something that I know from listening to other podcasts you've been on that you have a distinct love of and that you wish more people loved, which is exactly what the show is about. So that's perfect. So
yeah, I was psyched when I heard you were starting this because there's so many things in geek culture I think are unfairly maligned. So like, I think it's a great name for a show.
Excellent. So why don't you tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around its release, when it was released, its reception upon release, why people malign it, and why you think they are wrong to do so.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope this can be a bit of a conversation. So it's not just a monologue for me, but, you know, I love Star Trek Voyager. I love Star Trek Voyager unapologetically. I think it is by far the best Star Trek that's ever come out for just a myriad of reasons. But just to kind of give a background about, you know, like how I approached the show. So, you know, I was a teenager in the 90s. I graduated from high school in the late 90s. And, you know, Star Trek Voyager was coming on television at that time. So when TNG was coming on and, you know, DS9, I kind of watched it a little, but I was so young, I couldn't really understand the show. And even as a child, it kind of seemed a little campy and silly.
This is the equivalent of when because I'm about 8 or 9 years older than you. So this is the equivalent I had with the original series.
Right.
Because the original series was not being originally shown, but being rerun, because there was no Next Generation when I was a child. So the original series would constantly being rerun. And I had exactly the same reaction. It was like, I kind of enjoyed it, but I was way too young and it already felt campy.
Right. No, I felt that same thing because they started running, you know, TOS on, you know, cable in the 90s, and I would watch them. It just had none of the magic of, you know, TNG or, you know, DS9. And I think that watching it now as an adult, I kind of have more of a frame of reference about, you know, what the tone of the show was, why it was groundbreaking, and I can appreciate that more. But, you know, for me, Star Trek Voyager was the Voyager that came on television while I was in high school. And I will never forget, like, staying up late to watch it on UPN as it was airing. And to me, it was an absolutely breakthrough show at the time. Just to kind of start with the basics, I think the way that it was shot and filmed and the special effects, I think it's the first Star Trek that really holds up even today. I think if you look at some of the CG of you know, DS9, like Odo transforming, it just doesn't hold up very well. Like the Fong shading on Odo as he's turned to liquid, it looks cheesy and bad. To me, the design work and special effects of Voyager almost universally still hold up today. You know, obviously being, you know, kind of a well-known feminist figure in the tech industry, one of my biggest love of Voyager is I think it's an unapologetically feminist Star Trek. It's not just having a woman captain. You know, this Star Trek has by far more women characters than any other Star Trek. There's Kes, Captain Janeway, B'Elanna Torres, Seven of Nine. And they're not just, you know, they're not just there as like supportive roles. Like, as much as I love Dax, I feel like she's more of a secondary character on that show. This kind of there for other characters to have their adventure. You know, B'Elanna really drives the plot. Seven of Nine really drives the plot. And, you know, they've done studies that have like looked at which Star Trek's passed the Bechdel test. And Voyager just beats it by miles all the rest of the series. And yeah, that's really important to me. It was the first Star Trek that really made me feel like I was a part of this culture. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I did. That was one of the things I noted. I was going to ask if that was one of the reasons you liked Voyager so much, because it is, it did always feel to me, from a casual view perspective. Now, I'm not a big Trekkie. I like Star Trek, fine. Mm-hmm. And I have watched, you know, many episodes of various series, but I'm not, you know, a hardcore fan. And from a casual viewer's perspective at that time, the main thing I sort of was aware of it for, and that I remember it for, was that Janeway was the first female captain on Star Trek, or at least right. That's how it felt. I don't know, maybe there were other female captains in the movies or something, but certainly you think of Star Trek mainly as being on TV, and, you know, she was the prominent first female captain. And that she was an older woman, not some sexy young ingenue with a low-cut top, you know. I liked that, and I was always glad that they'd finally done something like that with Trek, because it did have this reputation. You know, by the time Next Generation had come along and sort of everyone had re-examined the original series, you realized in context what a breakthrough some of the parts of the original series had been and how much it had pushed boundaries. And so it was, I thought it was kind of a logical progression, it seemed, to have, okay, well, let's have a female captain. Nobody's done that. We'll do that because we're Star Trek, and that's the sort of move forward thing that we do.
Right. I think if you look at past Treks from like a feminist perspective, you know, TOS, like a lot of hardcore Trekkies will often talk about how breakthrough it was. I find that show to be, frankly, very sexist. I mean, you know, there's the Turnabout Intruder episode, which is horrible for any number of reasons. But, you know, it is a bunch of white dudes having an adventure in space. And then women are generally relegated to having like mini dresses and eye candy in the background. And like,
and being the nurse. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. And from a modern perspective, it is horribly sexist. But this is what I meant about context. The very fact that there was a woman in an officer's position on the bridge in the shape of Uhura was actually kind of, I mean, it's ridiculous, but that was a breakthrough at the time.
Right. But, you know, obviously I have to look at it with modern eyes, so I can appreciate that context. But, you know, like when I watch scenes of Dr. McCoy slapping a pregnant woman, which he does on the show, like he's trying to examine her and she like doesn't like it. And then he like slaps her and then like runs his medical tricorder on her. And that's just, it's really difficult to watch. And, you know, even going on to, you know, DS9 and TNG, which again are better. But, you know, Counselor Troi, I would really describe her as a supporting character. She very rarely drives the plot. Beverly Crusher seems like she's mostly there as kind of sexual tension for, you know, Captain Picard. And, you know, they killed off Tasha Yar very, very quickly on that show. So I have to say, like, there are some episodes of TNG I really like, but as a whole, it doesn't feel like it really tries to include me. Yeah, the same thing with DS9. I think, you know, again, Dax is a very cool character, and I like her, but she just kind of pushes me away. So, you know, Voyager is the first Star Trek that really felt like I belonged there. But even getting beyond the feminist angle, I think it's an amazing show. Like, when I think about Star Treks that really hold up over the entire, like, run of the series, I think Voyager had the best overarching plot by far of any of the Star Treks. You know, there's this kind of mission for them to get home from the Delta Quadrant. And what's really interesting is the progression of the series as it goes along. Like, the Doctor slowly becomes a human. The Doctor eventually, you know, gets this mobile emitter so he can be, you know, walk around and is freed from that. You have Seven of Nine joining the crew, which really changes the dynamics. You see, like, Tom Paris and B'Elanna Torres greatly changing over the series. And you see Captain Janeway's captaining style really change as well. So I think there's this wonderful evolution of the design work and the characters over all seven seasons of Star Trek Voyager. And it's just this beautiful, really interesting arc. It really rewards viewers that know it and love it.
I mean, that's why people love Deep Space Nine. or why a lot of people are Deep Space Nine, is that, you know, like also like Babylon 5, it feels like a consistent, coherent story that happens to be spread over a number of seasons. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of surprising that most people don't sort of have the same appreciation of Voyager for that reason, at least. And it did run, as you say, for 7 seasons. So, and I had this conversation with Jason Snell on the very first show talking about Stargate. You know, Stargate ran for 10 years.
Yeah.
You don't run for 10 years unless you're quite popular. And it, you don't run for 7 seasons unless, you know, if nobody's watching, you're not going to get 7 seasons out of a show. So even though people think back to Voyager now and think of it as some kind of terrible failure in the Star Trek mythology, clearly people were watching it at the time.
Yeah, well, and I have to say something about that. Like, you know, you said there's this common conception that Voyager was a failure. I think this is wholly unfair and just simply not accurate. You know, not just... I feel a comment that I get a lot from people about Voyager is you'll talk to Star Trek fans and they'll just say very dismissively, like, oh, I just didn't watch that after season one. I just couldn't. And as a really hardcore Star Trek fan, I find that a really difficult mindset to understand, because even the very worst Star Trek, I've seen every episode of it multiple times, because there's, like, even the worst Star Trek is enjoyable, even like the animated series. So, I mean, I would argue, if you're like, oh, no, I didn't watch that, that I would have to argue reluctantly that that's not a super informed viewpoint.
And you should leave your Star Trek card at the door.
Well, maybe not that far, but, you know, I mean, I think there's no test to become a Star Trek fan. But, you know, I think that you have to be familiar with Voyager to give it mature criticism. Does that make sense to you? Like, you need to understand it.
Absolutely. And I'm also, the first thought that comes to mind is, can you imagine if those same people hadn't watched, if people had given up on TNG after season one?
Right.
Because the first season of Next Generation is not very good.
It's horrible.
It really isn't.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a couple of seasons for that show to really find its footing. Now, you can say that it had exceptional circumstances because it was the first new Star Trek show in, you know, 20 years or however long it was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, the fact is that a lot of shows actually take half a season at least, and sometimes a season or more, to really find their footing. Even nowadays, when shows are getting cancelled after 5 episodes.
No, I definitely agree. But this is where I think Voyager is held to a double and a triple standard. So let's talk honestly about TOS. There are maybe 20 episodes of TOS that are good. Like, let's be honest, the vast majority of them are painful to watch. And all of season 3 is just terrible. So, like, with that, you're batting, like, at best, a 1 in 3 episodes are good. You know, TNG, of which I've seen every episode of now as an adult, is very, 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 very inconsistent. You know, the first season, my husband actually bet me $100. I couldn't watch it all the way through without watching anything else along the way. That was a very, very hard-fought $100 because it's just, it's terrible. You know, DS9, I think, is also very, very irregular. Like, there are vast, periods of time in that show, particularly when they, Nog or Quark is, like, a really famous, you know, they base the plot around them. It's just not good. I think Voyager, overall, has the vast... It just has a really winning record that any episode you watch is probably going to be solid. And like all Star Treks, there are probably about 5, 6, 7 episodes that are horrible, particularly the ones at Star Chakotay. But, you know, all of them are pretty solid overall. And I think it's a double standard the show is held to.
I wonder as well if that double standard is part of the oft-cited standard of women generally in, you know, business and tech and pretty much all industry, where there's a feeling that women have to work twice as hard to be seen as merely as competent as an equivalent man. And I wonder if that is applied to Voyager because it is seen as a female-led series. You know, you associate every Star Trek series with its captain. And so Janeway, of course, is the sort of figurehead of Voyager. So yeah, I wonder if the same double standard there is applied. People think, oh, if this was a series starring a man, starring somebody like, you know, Picard or Sisko or whoever, instead, would they be as down on it? I mean, that's impossible to say, obviously, but it does, you know, the question is raised.
I have a lot to say about that. You know, if we're talking about geeks overall, geek culture, and look, I'm a software engineer, so I am absolutely a geek. You know, male geeks tend to think that sexism is like two guys sitting around chomping on a cigar, drinking gin, saying, like, broads can't code, you know? And it's just not the truth. Like, I can say scientifically, most discrimination against women is unconscious. You know, there's unconscious discrimination.
It's institutional, yeah.
It's institutional. It's filled with assumptions they're just not even aware of. And the criticisms I hear of Janeway, I just got to be honest with you, they sound flat out sexist to me every single time I hear them. You know, people say, like, she was a dumb captain. She didn't make decisions. She was too emotional is one I hear a lot.
Oh, wow, really?
No, I hear that all the time. Like, oh, she was wishy-washy. You know, and it's just so unfair. And what I believe is happening is I think the average Star Trek fan, I think part of Star Trek culture is I think there's kind of a little bit of resentment with a lot of Star Trek fans because they feel like they could go write the show or run the show better than the writers, which is why I think there's so much delight taken in, like, finding plot holes. Like, the truth of the characters is the same, and the truth of the story is the same, even if you find what you feel to be some plot hole there. Mm-hmm. But you know, people will just seize on it and attack it as if it invalidates the entire work that this very talented team of artists and actors and writers did. And that just seems, frankly, childlike to me. So I think that what happens with Janeway is I think unconsciously it doesn't fit into what a lot of male geeks feel that a leader should be, which, look, let's be honest, like, you know, 3 out of 5 of the major captains have been, you know, white, straight dudes. So, you know, I think there's a lot of double standards that Janeway is held to.
I don't think you realize that you are not in control here anymore.
I can kill you and your crew in an instant.
Go ahead. Without us, you won't be able to prevent this ship from being torn apart by the pulsars. And even with my crew working together, I'd say the odds of us getting through this are what? 1 in 10?
1 in 20, at best, Captain.
I'm willing to take that chance. Are you?
Outer hull temperature has reached 9,000 degrees.
The hull's beginning to buckle.
2 alien vessels are attempting to disengage from Voyager.
Can't break us free of the gravitational forces.
Then let's divert all power to the shields.
No, if we go in full throttle.
Captain?
Assuming we survive, we're gonna need all the momentum we can get to reach escape velocity on the other side. Everyone, hang on. I hope you were exaggerating about those odds, Tuvok.
I was not.
I think that also carries over to the discussion of 7 of 9. If one more person talks to me about how 7 of 9 is just a sexed up bimbo that they brought along to save the series and starts talking on her boobs, I'm going to slap somebody. It really makes me frustrated because she's such a deep, awesome character. I would put 7 of 9 up against anyone else in the entire Star Trek pantheon about being just a good character. I think there's Spock, I think there's 7 of 9, and I think there's the Doctor as far as being a really, really compelling character. And, you know, she has this wonderful arc of discovering her humanity, and she's dead competent, and she's set up against Janeway in this kind of motherly slash competitive relationship. And it's just a really, really wonderful arc to see her discover herself over the course of that show. And for me as a software engineer, I don't think of 7 of 9 as a sex symbol when I think of her at all. I think of her as a very competent scientist. I think of her as someone in pain, and I think of her as a leader. And I think it really speaks to the unconscious bias of male Star Trek fans that the primary thing that they think of Seven of Nine about is a sex symbol.
It is her tight outfit, yeah.
Right, right. And she's gorgeous. But that's not, that's instant, you know, it's not who her character is.
One thing I didn't realize that I found reading up on this before the show, I actually didn't realize that Seven of Nine came into Voyager relatively late, because she so quickly, and, you know, sadly, inevitably, given her sex appeal, she so quickly became the poster girl for the show that I must have, like, here's another comic film, I must have retconned my own memories to assume that she'd always been in it, because, like I say, I didn't watch a whole lot of Voyager. I saw a few episodes. I didn't even see the pilot.
Wow.
But I knew the premise, right, certainly, and I knew that it was the female captain and the Native American first mate and all that sort of stuff. But I always just assumed that Seven of Nine was a character who'd been in it from the start.
No, it was, she showed up at the end of season three in an episode called Scorpion, where it kind of been leading up to Captain Janeway was going to face the Borg. And then they got rid of Cass in the second episode of season four, and like Seven of Nine took the mainstay. But a lot of male Star Trek fans insist that it was her sex appeal brought on to save the show. And I wholly reject that. I think it is a very myopic argument that, again, is just valuing Seven of Nine for her looks. Like, let's think about the overall arc of Voyager. Voyager is a show about getting home. So season one, you're fighting the Kazons, and, you know, it goes on. I'm not going to get into, like, a delineation of every season, but Janeway knew she would eventually have to go through Borg space, and she did. And it became a metaphor, like Seven of Nine being on the show was a metaphor for this larger conflict of Seven of Voyager trying to get through Borg space in some of the best episodes that they ever had. And there's this wonderful dichotomy of the Doctor has grown to the point of him feeling like a human and having gone through a lot of the same trauma that Seven has. And, you know, he kind of becomes a father to her, trying to help her discover her humanity again. And then Voyager, like Captain Janeway, is trying to be both a friend and a mentor to Seven of Nine as they're solving these problems. And, you know, it's not they didn't bring her on for sex appeal. They brought her on for some of the best episodes this show ever had.
Hmm. That is interesting. Yeah, as I say, as somebody who didn't really watch the series, I wasn't aware of that. And I admit to being guilty of, you know, being one of those people who just assumed that she was in the show to be sexy.
Well, I think it speaks to a problem with the monoculture of geekdom. You know, it's like, look, let's be honest. Like, people like you have a lot more voice, you know, commonly than I do. I'm kind of shocked that on, you know, Relay FM, no one has really done a prominent tech show with women in tech before Rocket, which is astonishing to me, you know. So take this perspective, perhaps. You know, women are half the planet, right? So for me growing up, you know, obviously I love video games because I went into game development. So I want for you to imagine what it was like for me growing up and looking at video games and seeing how few women there were. I mean, there's Jessica in Double Dragon who, you know, in the opening cinematic, yeah, like, you know, she's punched in the stomach and, you know, pulled over someone's shoulder and carted off. And the truth is, yeah, throughout the NES and Super NES era, women, generally speaking, are bimbos and damsels in distress. I can really only think of two or three characters from the NES era that really stood out as strong women. And I can only think of, you know, a few more from the Super Nintendo era. And this carries over to television. So, yeah, I want you to really think about how much it meant to me as an aspiring software engineer to watch Voyager and to see Captain Janeway, who is a leader. And Captain Janeway does not run the ship the same way Kirk does. If you think people hate her now, like, imagine what would have happened if Captain Janeway had just barked orders at people the way Kirk can.
Yeah.
Or showed the fury that Captain McCard does. You know, it's the double standard that women are held to. You know, but she doesn't do that. She's generally speaking much more of a consensus builder and a scientist. So you have Captain Janeway, who's a leader and a scientist. You have B'Elanna Torres, who never feels like she belongs, but is a brilliant engineer. And, you know, you have Kes, not the strongest character, but a solid one. You know, you have Seven of Nine when she shows up. And again, it's this very strong scientist character who is very sure of herself, doesn't apologize for her emotions, and is deadly competent at her job. And what I can tell you, for me, that seemed like such an aspirational figure. Like, here were women in a really geeky series that had these traits that I had really only seen in men up till that point. So it was just hugely aspirational.
As I said earlier, that's why I was so glad to see something like this come from the Trek stable, because it always felt like that element had been missing somewhat from Star Trek. I never watched DS9, so I don't know how well that covered it, but certainly it felt like Voyager was more of it made more of a statement. It was more like saying, no, we are unapologetically, this show is led by a woman, is, you know, a female-led show, deal with it. And I really liked that and appreciated that about the show.
So let me ask you this, like, you're more of a casual viewer of it, but what is it about the show? Were there things that kind of pushed you away a little bit? Like, how did you feel about the show?
No, the episodes that I saw, I mean, like I said, I never saw the pilot. I just kind of had the premise explained to me by somebody else as, oh, it's a Star Trek ship that's been teleported into distant space, so they're on their own and trying to find their way back home. I mean, that is basically the high concept. And by the way, I think that's a great high concept.
Yeah.
Because it had certainly never been done before in Star Trek. It's not something that you see an awful lot in science fiction in general. There have been more things made now, perhaps influenced by Voyager, about that kind of, oh, we've been accidentally transported somewhere and now we've got to find our way home. But at the time, it felt like a genuinely new and original concept. And I always liked that it was, this is totally different to everything you've seen before on Star Trek. So yeah, I thought that was great, but I only saw a few episodes and they were fine. They didn't really grab me, but they certainly didn't push me away. Hmm. It was more just about my, tastes, other things I was doing. I didn't watch a lot of TV at all in the late 90s, to be honest. And at the time I was more big into, role-playing games and very heavily into music. And, those were kind of taking up more of my time, basically.
Well, I mean, that's cool. I also think there was, frankly, a lot better science fiction on television in the late 90s, like, you know, Stargate and a whole bunch of, you know, more minor shows like that. I think, like, talking about the high concept of Voyager, something I really appreciate is, you know, I'm sorry, I know there are a lot of hardcore DS9 fans out there, and I think it's the second best Trek, probably, but I get so bored with the idea of, you know, Benjamin Sisko as like the emissary and like being this spiritual leader to the Bajoran people. I actually don't think that's a very great high concept for a show. I think they did interesting things with it. But, you know, I think the Bajorans are not innately interesting on their own. They're only interesting in, like, when you contrast them to the Cardassians and they're in this Batman/Joker, you know, intertwined relationship. So I don't think that's very good. I think Star Trek Enterprise is another show that has been kind of unfairly maligned.
I would agree with that, actually.
Yeah. I think for seasons 3 and 4 of it, it got really, really good. You know, especially when they went to the Expanse to, you know, figure out the Zindi and stop Earth from being destroyed. That's when they gave the show an overall mission. And that's when it started clicking and working. So I don't know. I think just from a high concept, it was just amazing.
Yeah, like I said, it was that was what grabbed me first and made me think, oh, this is interesting. But like I say, it wasn't that the show drove me away. I just had lots of other things, you know, occupying my time. Let's move on to more of the sort of technical stuff for a moment, because
Sure.
You said right at the start that you felt it held up better than other Trek, or the other Trek of that age, and that the shooting methods felt more modern. And also, I again found out while reading up on this prior to the show, apparently Voyager was the first Trek to go all CGI for exterior spaceship shots, which they did, I think, in the third season.
Correct.
Which is interesting, because I must admit, I thought they'd have gone all CGI long before the third season of Voyager. So it's interesting that they waited so long. Do you think that contributed to why it stands up, perhaps?
I think it's a complicated subject. You know, I do 3D for a living, so I could get into like a deeper...
Well, that's another reason I wanted to ask you about this.
Sure. So talking generally speaking, like at a very high level, one of the things we had kind of figured out in 3D by the time Star Trek came along was some more complicated rendering methods. Like I wasn't there at the studio, so I don't know their exact method for doing it, but... Very generally speaking, if you're looking at like Odo dissolving into like a pool of liquid metal or whatever he is, if you look at it, you'll see it's just this kind of shiny, reflective, neutral material with some texture on it.
It's Terminator 2 level, isn't it?
It is. It's the same software they used for that, but it's this it's what we call a Fong. That's the name of the material type with this like, you know, shiny layer on top of it, which is it's a very primitive, it's a very fast rendering material because computers were much less powerful in that age. When you got to Voyager, again, speaking very generally, and again, I didn't work on the studio, but this is why I see as someone that deals with this all day, we had more advanced shaders and rendering engines like Mental Ray, for instance, in Maya, which lets you... basically have a lot more control, and glass can look more like glass, grass can look like grass, metal can look like metal, and it's not just like a texture and a surface, like you're getting down and calculating what the material looks like with a bunch of different values. So one of the reasons they haven't brought it over to Blu-ray yet is because those were rendered at relatively low pixel resolutions. It would be hard
to... Oh, so they'd have to re-render everything.
They would, and that's one of the reasons they haven't done that, especially for the special effects shots. But I do think it holds up better. I think an unsung thing about Voyager is the ship design work. I would put the design of Voyager and some of the smaller things in Voyager, like there's an episode with the Captain Ransom, and what's the name of it? Is it the Eclipse? I forget the name of it, but there's basically a Star Trek a Starfleet science ship that gets lost in the Delta Quadrant. And it's a smaller science ship, and they have to make some really dark choices to survive. And it's just a beautiful ship design. You have the Prometheus, which I would say is one of the most beautiful Star Trek ships ever done. And I just think there's this really beautiful interior aesthetic that just holds up beautifully. Even the alien designs, the Kazons were kind of a weak enemy right out of the gate, but they really solidified the look of the Borg over Voyager, and I think it's just beautiful. You know, things like Species 8472 were really the first Star Trek fully CG characters that they did, and I think some of the material shaders on the skin don't hold up, but overall it's a really good effort.
Was this around the time they were making the Next Generation movies as well?
Yes, it was.
So presumably they would have been sharing design resources, because the Borg featured in those quite heavily, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And you can see like they set up a bunch of lines back and forth to work with that. But it's interesting you mentioned the movies. Like there are shots in First Contact and Insurrection, these beautiful shots of... like escape pods being jettisoned from the Enterprise. And you see this wonderful triangular design as it's like separating from the hull and these shadows along the way. And it really shows like those same effects really carried over to Voyager. Like Voyager was the first Star Trek where the ship actually landed on a planet. And you see like the legs telescoping out, or, you know, you see things like the Borg Queen being assembled in CG, like all of her limbs flying onto her body. It's just awesome. And I think the technical sophistication of it was drastically better than DS9.
I didn't know that Voyager was the first ship to land on a planet, but one of the things I was going to comment on with the ship design was, of all the hero ship designs in Star Trek, you know, the various iterations of the Enterprise and all that. The Voyager was the only one that felt solid enough, compact enough, that it could actually fly through an atmosphere. Like, all the others have spindly bits.
Mm-hmm.
You
right.
know, various spindly bits that you think, yeah, if that was in an atmosphere, that would just shear off. That wouldn't be able to cope. Whereas Voyager felt very compact and solid as a design.
Right.
And felt like it actually could fly through the air, given enough thrust, obviously. And I really liked, the one thing I do remember about it was, Voyager, correct me if I'm wrong, was the one where I don't know what they're called, is it the impulse engines? Rotated before it went into warp speed.
They never really explained why that happened on the show, which
no, but it was a neat
about.
Effect. The first time I saw that, I remember thinking, oh, I like that. Yeah, you know, different sort of flight mode, yeah.
No, it was great.
That appeals to the 10-year-old Thunderbirds fan in me, I think.
No, I definitely agree. I think also the feel of Voyager, it feels like the Enterprise has a very, or at least TNG Enterprise, has a very looming capital ship feeling to it, one that they only expanded as it went, you know, to the Enterprise, you know, E, where it was really wide in the saucer section. What I love about Voyager is so much of the emotional toll of Voyager is their feelings of being stranded in the Delta Quadrant. And I think the design of the ship works so beautifully along with that, because it's like this sleek, tiny vessel that feels powerful and solid, but also feels like it's built to go fast. But it doesn't feel like this looming weapon. It feels like solid, but...
Yeah, it looked like a ship designed to move.
Yeah.
Rather than to stand and fight, it looked like, yeah, as you say, I mean, not exactly sleek, because it was kind of squat and thick, but it looked like a ship designed for people to travel in.
So can we talk, I have to talk a little bit about some of the characters on this show, because I feel like we talked about Seven of Nine and Janeway. But I think you can't talk about Voyager without talking about the Doctor, who is a wonderfully nuanced character. You know, he's so flawed and so pompous and so arrogant. But at the same time, like, there's something so beautiful about this character that's so hurt and vulnerable and, like, uses his pride to, like, hide that vulnerability. And matures and changes so much over the course of the show. And, I mean, it explores, like, I think science fiction at its best uses these themes as, like, almost, an analog to conflicts that we feel in the real world. And I think, like, what happened to the Doctor? Like, he had some wonderful episodes, like critiquing the United States healthcare system, where, you know, like, he gets sent to this clinic where only the rich get healthcare, basically. You know, the things that happen to him are very clear analogs to racial discrimination and even gay rights, which was a really hot topic in the late 90s. So I think there's this wonderful, wonderful growth of the character. There are even episodes where, like, legal tribunals sit down and decide if, like, the Doctor has legal rights as a person, which, again, like, if you compare that to what's going on here in the United States right now, there's, you know, these are very topical, important things for science fiction to deal with.
I was actually a little surprised, again, because I didn't know that much about the series or didn't remember that much anyway. I was a little surprised to see that the Klingon wasn't the security officer this time around, that she was the engineer.
Right.
Because it had, Worf made it such, because Worf was such a good character, and, you know, Michael Dorn played that role so well, that the idea, you know, you'd think, well, why wouldn't you have the most warlike character in on your ship to be the security officer? You know, it just kind of makes sense. And then I see that actually on this one, it was a Vulcan.
Yeah.
It was Tuvok.
Well, it was a black Vulcan too, you know, which is another breakthrough, right?
Which I find interesting, fascinating even.
I think that Voyager played on our expectations quite a bit. You know, so I think those characters are great. I think if we were to, like, have some constructive criticism, I think Kes is probably one of the worst characters in all of Star Trek history. I still think there's a ground floor of enjoyability to her arc. And in fact, there's a wonderful episode after she's kicked off the ship, basically, for the start of season four. I think it's season six where she comes back in this episode called Fury. And she's so angry at having been betrayed by Voyager. Because, like, they stranded her, and her arc after she left the show was horrible, that she comes back trying to destroy the entire crew. And it's a really dark episode. But
so she's like a female Khan.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. But I think leading up to that, I think it's very interesting if you look at Jennifer Lean, she really never acted in anything again. And, you know, I say this with respect, like, she obviously achieved a lot to be on an important show. Like, that's a great career achievement. But I would argue she's probably one of the weaker actresses in Star Trek canon. I also think it's worth saying my husband has massive problems with Harry Kim. As someone white, I didn't have a lot of the lived experience of being Asian that Frank does. Being married to him, I've grown to be infinitely more conscious of the way that Asian people are represented in films and television. And what he feels, and what I was frankly too blind to see, is all too often Asian people are represented as this, like, joke. They're frequently emasculated. They never get the girl. There's a sidekick. And Harry Kim absolutely falls into every one of those traps. He is the punchline for, you know, being alongside Tom Paris, who's this, you know, kind of white leading man kind of guy. And I do think, as someone that's very familiar with Voyager, I think Harry Kim does have an arc, and Harry Kim does grow. And I love Harry Kim as a character, but I can see how that representation of an Asian is not up to par. And I think in a show that does so much groundbreaking work with the way it represents women, the same way I think DS9 did a lot of breakthrough work in, you know, representing black people, you know, in, like, family dynamics and romance as, you know, in really complex, beautiful ways, I think, like, they frankly failed on that front. But to kind of get back to Voyager, I also think Chakotay. I think Chakotay is flat out probably the worst character in all of Star Trek history.
Wow. Really?
And I think about it. I mean, his episodes that feature Chakotay are almost all horrible. There's the fight, which, you know, was where he's hallucinating. He's a boxer. I mean, it's, you know, there's another one where he gets trapped on a planet. There are a lot of ones where he, like, there's another one where he's a coma and people are, like, moving things on a medicine wheel in a sick bay to, like, get him, you know, to communicate with the spirit animal. It's, he's just not a very good character. And I think that Star Trek really could have done better with the first officer dynamic there.
Yeah, well, and presumably also with Native American representation.
Yeah, yeah.
Given that Robert Beltran isn't even Native American.
Right.
In the grand tradition of American television casting.
I don't know enough about what, you know, Native Americans are looking for in their representation, but it seems stereotypical from, you know, a layperson's view of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's all about spirit animals and quests and, like, trying to separate from the tribe. It seems very stereotyped to me, at least. I don't know how you feel.
No, I agree. I was introduced by my partner to the Tony Hillerman novels. He did a series of novels set around the Navajo reservation. They're all murder mysteries, you know, crime novels, set around the Navajo reservation in New Mexico and Arizona. And they're wonderful. And one of the great things about them is that they were... And these are not recent, you know, he started doing these in like the 80s, I believe. And one of the great things about them was that they were a very realistic and warts and all portrayal of Navajo life. Joe Leaphorn, that was the name of the detective, his main detective. It didn't give it a gloss, but it also didn't stereotype it. And it even addressed the issue of white people's stereotypes of Native Americans, and, as you say, things like, you know, the spirit animals and the prayer wheels and you know, whatever, all the dream catchers and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It really, it was very much a kind of a realistic portrayal. And that did mean including things that weren't necessarily complimentary, but they were real. And, you know, the punchline is that his books are now used as a resource in some Navajo schools to teach Navajo about their culture and about their history, because they were so well researched and he took so much care in that aspect of the books. So it can be done, you know. you can get a much better, more nuanced, even a modern series like Longmire, which I'm a big fan of, has a very nuanced view of Native American life. So you can get it. It is possible. And even in the 80s and 90s, it was possible to have it. And so, yeah, I do feel that treating Chakotay in that way was probably not, you know, not the greatest representation that Native American viewers could hope for.
Yeah. I mean, these things are iterative, you know. It's, I don't know. I think I would also say, like, a character on Voyager that's often pilloried is Neelix. And Neelix is a character I hated at first. I hated him so much. But, you know, as I've gotten older and I've rewatched the series, I think, I think he's kind of treated unfairly. I think that he's a, I think that there's a cheery hopefulness with him, and I think he really serves to humanize the cast. And I think because they're all searching for home, and so is Neelix because Talax was destroyed. And I think he has a really important part on that show. I think he's a very human element, even though he is kind of annoying sometimes. So
he seems to serve the same purpose as Guinan. People come to him and talk to him about their problems, which obviously can be a plot device, but as a character device can also be used to, you know, bounce character development off of somebody else.
Yeah, definitely. So I think I would say this, because I'd like to, as a software engineer, I like to leave with, like, courses of action. So I would say, if you're out there and you want to give Voyager a fairer shot, there are some episodes I would very strongly recommend for you. So these are episodes I would put up against any Star Trek series ever. Like, I would put these episodes up against, like, Best of Both Worlds. They're so good. So I would say, if you're out there, here are the best episodes of Voyager. There's Course Oblivion, which, I guess I'll spoil it a little bit. So this is a episode of Voyager where it opens up with B'Elanna Torres dying. And what you find, all the people on Voyager find out they're actually copies of people on Voyager. And it is the most gut-wrenching, horrible, terrible, powerful hour of television, I would say, in all of Star Trek history. There are some other really, really good ones. If you want to go dark, there's Timeless, which is basically Voyager explodes and dies. Only Chakotay and Harry Kim manage to survive, and they go back 20 years later and try to save the ship. It is an amazingly powerful episode. There is, for more fun ones, there's Year of Hell, which is a very, very powerful episode. There's Scorpion Part 1 and Part 2. This is where Janeway kind of runs into the Borg. There's Equinox Part 1 and Part 2, which is where Voyager finds this other star fleet vessel that has been trapped out in the Delta Quadrant that's made some horrible choices. And I would actually say Endgame is a really, really good episode.
That's the final episode.
That's the final episode. I would say all of the Voyagers, all the Star Trek final episodes are really mixed if you look back at them. Like, I don't think All Good Things is very good. Yeah, These Are the Voyages is really bad, I would argue. Turnabout Intruder is a horrible, horrible episode. But I think, Endgame is, it's a really, really solid episode of Voyager. And it gives every kind of closure to that you could want. There's also Message in the Bottle, which is a really, really fun episode where the Doctor basically goes back to the Alpha Quadrant ahead of Voyager by being, like, transmitted through a wormhole. And it's just a wonderfully fun episode. So, you know, go look at those episodes. And, you know, these are free on Netflix. Most geeks have Netflix. So, you know, watch them. Give the show a fair shot.
I may well do that myself. I may well seek out those episodes and watch them myself.
All right, there we go.
How's about that for a course of action?
I like it.
All right, let's bring it to a close then. Brianna Wu, thank you very much. And where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Absolutely. We have two shows on Relay FM, Isometric, which is a video game podcast, and we have Rocket, which I co-host with Christina Warren and also Simone de Rochefort. That's a really awesome tech show. You can follow me on Twitter at SpaceCatGal, and you can buy our, if you like games with strong women, go buy Revolution 60 on the App Store.
Important to mention that SpaceCatGal is with a K.
That is very important. It's critical information, so...
All right, Brianna Wu, thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, episode 16, with Anthony Johnston and Brianna Wu. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I don't want to keep saying this, but this is actually another parallel with comics. Mm-hmm. In that we have, I mean, as I'm sure you're aware, there is a movement at the moment, a very pro-feminist, pro-equality movement in comics, which is... having, I mean, it's nowhere near the level of something like Gamergate, but it is having that sort of backlash against it. There's a lot of argument going on. And there is this feeling amongst those threatened, basically, amongst the old guard, that like, oh, you're going to take all our toys away. We're not allowed to have sexy women anymore. And for years, long before this movement really sort of gained any steam, for years, all of my female comic reading friends have always said to these people, no, we have no problem with sexy women. But we want them to be characters, not,
right,
as Kelly Sue DeConnick so beautifully puts it, not just a sexy lamp.
Right.
You know, her argument is if you can replace a character with a sexy lamp and the plot doesn't change, then that's not a character. And clearly you can't do that with Seven of Nine. She is, as you say, a rounder character who just also happens to be drop-dead gorgeous.
No, I think that's really true in comics. I mean, look at Psylocke. Psylocke is one of my favorite characters in all of X-Men history. And yeah, she's probably the sexiest X-Man. But, you know, when I think about her, I think of someone that's like struggling to find her identity after the Siege Perilous and, you know, struggling with her identity as Quannon or Betsy Bradlock. And, you know, like when it gets to Uncanny X-Force, I mean, she is a really tortured character. Like she's almost Jack Bauer-like in that sense. And, you know, again, it's like, I mean, I work out a lot, and when I go to the gym, I wear, like, tight running clothes because that's efficient. Like, you don't want to, like, run with stuff flopping everywhere. So especially, too, as an artist, like, I learned to draw by opening up comic books and drawing, like, Psylocke, Marvel Girl, like, all these characters. So I actually don't have a problem with sexy women in comic books, just like I don't have a problem with Seven of Nine. I think it speaks to the immense bias of male Star Trek fans that they cannot see her beyond their looks. And
they can't see beyond the sexiness, yeah.
Right. And I would say, like, you know, that's not a... it doesn't make you a bad person, if that's the first thing that comes to mind. Like, you know, men are programmed in a really low level in our society to primarily value women for our looks. And, you know, I would just say, like, maybe think about that and question those assumptions.
I think you can take something positive from that, or I hope people can take something positive from that, because it shows that those kinds of progressive identification in fiction of characters, which is important, regardless of what people may say, it is really important. You know, it takes time. It takes time. But we're getting there bit by bit. I mean, when I think to it's very common. It's almost a joke now, isn't it, to have the sort of token Asian character in most American cop shows. But when I think about those Asian characters, they are varied. They're not all math geniuses, or they're not all, you know, like with parents from Vietnam, or You know, some of them do have wives and girlfriends. Some of them are even authority figures, you know, lieutenants and stuff in some cop precinct. So, as I say, I don't have a lot of perspective on this, on the Asian experience, but I think that shows that we are moving forward. And I think, I hope that that means we're all moving forward for all representations and all identifications within fiction.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think Star Trek, though, has... I think it's fair to say they've kind of let down their Asian audience. And let's look at it. Sulu, I mean, you want to talk about George Takei and not being able to captain a starship, the Excelsior? Like, that was a whole mess. And, you know, he is largely a joke in TOS. Like, he's played up for a punchline. I mean, one of the most iconic scenes of Sulu is when he's shirtless and kind of crazy with the samurai sword.
Which is
and he's not even... there's also... Look at the way they treated Hoshi in Enterprise. I'm very sensitive to the way that they portray women. And I think T'Pol in Enterprise ranks as one of the strongest women in Star Trek history. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Hoshi, I would argue, is a very weak character. She's amazing in the Mirror Mirror episode of Enterprise, where she, spoilers, this is like a decade ago, she ends up becoming Empress of the entire Starfleet Federation. So, that was awesome. But I think Star Trek has kind of failed on that. You know what we should do an episode on is Dead Space Extraction. We should do that. I love it. I'm trying to remember from us having lunch together. You did not write that, or did you?
No, I did. Extraction, I did write. Yeah.
I love that game. That is such a good game. That gets me so angry. Like,
bless you.
No, I mean, what is that like for you to have, like, worked on something I think is a masterpiece on the Wii and to not have it having, you know, sold very well?
Well, I'm kind of... I'm not exactly the best-selling comics writer in existence either, so I'm kind of used to putting this stuff out there and then, you know, people just ignoring it, to be honest.
Oh, that's brutal. Yeah.
Extraction, though, suffered because, of course, it was on the Wii and, you know, people don't associate the Wii with... hardcore shooty shoot gaming.
Yeah.
That was its biggest issue. But I had a great time working on it. It was probably the sort of most coherent game narrative I'd worked on at that point. It was certainly the best script I'd written up until that point in my career. I had a great time working with the actors as well in the recording studios.
Yeah.
The whole thing was a wonderful experience for me. I just wish that more people had played it.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I mean, you have this, you know, the corporate head that is kind of slowly inculcated into this stuff, and there's this terrible dark arc with it, and main characters die, and the survival for it is just so heightened. Like, the entire time you play it, it is just horrific. Do you know what I mean? And, oh, it is, I love that game so much more than the other Dead Spaces, because... I feel like when I play a Dead Space, like, they're wonderful games, but they're ultimately puzzle-solving games. And the reason I like Dead Space is that emotion of fear and hopelessness. That is what draws me into that universe. And that script is so brilliant in the hopelessness of what you are feeling as a player. And I remember, like, my heart pounding for those boss battles. It was just horrific.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad you enjoyed it.
So I have to ask you, like, are you the person that wrote the line, "Man up, sweetheart"?
Yes.
Oh my God. I love that line. I use that line all the time.
Wonderfully delivered by Ramon Tikaram.
So beautiful. It's just like, so... He just throws the line aside, and it's such an afterthought. Is delivered in that British accent, and it is. Oh, I love that line. I want to get that just printed on a T-shirt, like I wear as a feminist. I'm out there in the world. Just man up, sweetheart, and say that to everyone. So I don't know. How much more time do we have? Can I talk about a few favorite episodes and then we'll call it?
I'll edit this down a bit anyway, yeah, because we have taken some digressions.
Oh my gosh. Sorry about that.